Hey, you meathead. You're listening to some more great gaming shows here on the Goblin Broadcast Network. Find some more at gbncom.com.
This is Luke Johnson, the writer who's worked with Wizards of the Coast, White Wolf, Goodman Games, and you're listening to The Tome. Woo!
Welcome to The Tome, episode 45. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews podcast, and I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be fighting Draconians with the Dragonlance movie. Welcome again to episode 45 of The Tome, Dragons of Autumn Twilight, the movie. In this episode, we have two special guests coming to talk to you about the Dragonlance movie. If you've decided that you want to check it out, you can find it and more at The Tome's Amazon store at www.thetomeshow.com. But without further ado, here's a little discussion on the Dragonlance movie.
Hey, this is your Tome host, Jeff Greiner, and today we'll be talking about the recent Dragonlance movie release. Unfortunately, I have not been able to get it through my Netflix subscription yet, so I brought in two fabulous experts to let us all know what's going on with the Dragonlance movie that everyone has such high hopes for. So with us today is JJ from Fistful of Comics and Games and Jeffrey D. Wynn, who you're familiar with from previous reviews on the show. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you. Thank
you very much. Glad to be here.
So what's the skinny on this Dragonlance movie?
Well, Jeff, do you want to give it a first lob at it, and I'll hit it back over the net?
The Dragonlance movie is the long-awaited adaptation of Dragons of Autumn Twilight, which would be the first book in the Dragonlance series. Started way, way back, I think, in the 70s, was it? Or 80s, probably.
It was roughly 84.
Roughly 84, same year as Ghostbusters came out in theaters, and written by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, who went on to become very famous for writing lots and lots and lots and lots of other books in the Dragonlance series.
And other novels as well, mostly
and
the fantasy.
Novels. And it's been we've been hearing about this movie for quite some time now. It's got some big-name actors. Kiefer Sutherland is Raistlin. We've got Lucy Lawless as Goldmoon. And we've got Michael Rosenbaum, Lex Luthor from Smallville, playing Tannis. And a few other names that I recognize that I don't know if anyone else would recognize. Plus, we have computer-animated dragons and... apparently, they got the Philharmonic Orchestra of some foreign country to do the soundtrack. And Margaret Weiss wrote poetry in Elvish. That's all I got.
That's all you got. Well, first off, I was. Let me ask you, Jeff. Have you or either of you read the original Dragons of Autumn Twilight?
I did read it. I first read it just like a year or two ago, like two or three years ago. I decided to sit down and read it, and I was actually impressed by the first book, just how, you know, after reading lots of the Ed Greenwood and R.A. Salvatore novels and just lots of that stuff, I was really surprised how good the Dragonlance books were compared to some of the more modern D&D novels.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they were kind of simple and childish.
And I've read the entire original trilogy, and then I guess I've continued to read the others. It's been a long time since I've read this specific book. It's been probably since I was in high school, so a good 12, 13 years ago now since I've read the original book. But I've gone back to the same world and to the same characters multiple times. Even most recently, I read Soulforge, which is a novel that gives some of the background on Raistlin specifically and his brother.
Now, I've got to preface my comments with the fact that I was in high school when these novels first came out, and I was introduced to the novels from a an underclassman at the time, and I kind of wrote it off, and I didn't actually pick up the books till I got to college. I bought a box set of the three novels because I remember that he spoke of them so highly, and they were one of the first novel series that were written specifically for a Dungeons and Dragons setting, and it was the first time Dungeons and Dragons and TSR in the days launched a real multimedia project. Here was a line of novels, here was a setting to play in with a series of modules that was going to support it using the standard D&D rules. They launched calendars and so forth, and they're just widely popular. And I read it basically as the books were coming out after I picked up the original trilogy, and I fell in love with them. I really did. They were very accessible, and it was kind of cool for the very first time that you could sit and read something that was D&D. You could tell that he was casting sleep and that he was using the proper material components and things like that. Little touches that really made it kind of cool. And so I come at this movie with a lot of fan in me. I'm a very big fan of both Hickman and Weiss for all of their works in both gaming and non-gaming fiction and so forth. And I have to say, I was disappointed in the ultimate outcome of the film because it was like a Reader's Digest version of so much information. And it just, everybody seemed like a cardboard cutout then. And I really wonder if they wouldn't have been able to do a better job if they had concentrated on the first half of the book. For those that aren't familiar with the novel, the first novel, Dragons of Autumn Twilight, is actually contained of two books, book one and book two. In those two books, there are essentially two separate goals that correspond to two modules in the series of modules that were released in the day. The first one ends when they retrieve the discs of Mishalka in the dungeon of Pax Tharkas. And that is a great point to in and of itself. It's a very high point. They've achieved their goal, and it ends in an awesome dungeon crawl. And then there's a second part where they have to free the slaves that are in, and the name escapes me now, but they have to free the slaves that have been captured, the refugees that have been captured. And that's a whole nother story in and of itself, and it adds new elements and new characters to the story. So for them trying to do both of those seemed to me a bit much. I'm not sure if Jeff, if you had gotten that feel that they had tried to do that or.
Well, I mean, I can see why. I mean, there are any number of difficulties trying to make Dragonlance novels into movies. Number one being they are nowhere near as popular as Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter or any of these other major franchises that they have tried to film. They were not at all certain that this was going to sell very well, so they just wanted to make what they could and try and make the most of it. I felt that the series suffered from a lack of budget, and it just felt very rushed, very poorly edited, very poorly planned out. I don't think they, there were lots of very technical problems that combined to make the movie just really bad and unwatchable. Pretty much the only real worthy thing about the movie is Kiefer Sutherland as Raistlin. I can just close my eyes and listen to him, and that's, I can enjoy that. But yeah, this is a movie you have to watch with your eyes closed, sort of. Well, first of all, they've got these computer animated dragons, which are, I mean, if you've seen any, modern movies in the past, 5, 10 years, you know what modern computer graphics look like, and these look like they were done at home on somebody's computer, and they were just very sloppily edited into the two-dimensional animation. I mean, you can see the 3D dragons and the 3D monsters interacting with the 2D characters, and there's just no comparison. They don't. It looks bad.
Right, and that was one of the. Now I have to, again, for those that aren't aware, I have a certain special power. My secret power is that I have a high tolerance for crap when it comes to movies. I mean, I have gone online and said that I did enjoy the first Dungeons and Dragons movie, but that being said,
even that was better than this.
Well, that being said, the 2D and 3D mixture was just too jarring. Where I've seen them mixed before in the past successfully is, sadly to say, in a Disney film. Disney would use, to a great degree, computer modeling for certain structures in their animation.
Yeah,
but
they
would
start doing that with, like, Aladdin.
Exactly. But they blend very well, and this was jarring. And all the dragons and all the draconians were 3D, and everybody else was 2D. And I don't know if you watched special features, but there was a place where you could see an early animatic of the animation.
I think it was the one that they showed at Dragon Con, and they said, oh, the final version will look better, and it doesn't.
Well, what I found there was that the drawings themselves were very well done. And I really wish they had just done 2D the whole way. And in this day and age, it's almost a shame that, you know, only on Cartoon Network and, you know, on Saturday morning television do you get to see traditional cell animated cartoons, you know. And here was a chance for them to do something like that and elevate the stature of the animated cartoon with some pretty serious subject matter.
I didn't really like the art style. I thought the character. Well, no, I didn't really like the art style. I'm more used to. Well, there's anime and also the modern Batman and Superman cartoons with very very smooth lines and. I didn't like the art style, but it looked even worse than 80s cartoons. You know, it looked worse
yeah.
than that.
It had a Filmation quality to it, not to slam Filmation, who has done a lot of great things in the day, but it did have that sort of Filmation quality to it.
Yeah, very, very, very cheap grocery store movie quality.
But I just wish they had been able to do more with those original drawings, because when I looked at the drawings and, you know, I look back at the covers from all the books and the modules, and the artwork for the series was done by a cadre of just great artists in the day: Clyde Caldwell, Jeff Easley, Larry Elmore was the go-to guy for Dragonlance. So the animation, I thought, was trying to capture that flavor, the style of art from all of these really great fantasy artists, and it did kind of fall short in that regards.
Yeah, the goblins look stupid. They had these big holes in the middle of their faces.
Mm-hmm. I didn't quite know what was going on with that.
Caramon didn't have his helmet.
Yes, that is true. And I think they spent too much time on Tika's ample...
That was funny. The whole opening of the movie was TNA. You had that scene of like the elves fleeing from the encroaching armies, and it was all like elf women in flimsy dresses.
Yeah, it was interesting, and I mean there is a relationship between that grows between Tika and Caramon, and it is one of the central themes of the series. You know, love kind of blossoming in this incredibly harsh, grueling environment. And it's a really neat theme, but they were playing it like, I don't know what. I mean, they were playing it like she was a Hooters waitress.
She sort of is. I mean, she's really the cheesecake of the group.
And here's where I'm saying that this is a Reader's Digest version of it, because in the book, very early on, and I'm going to go back to the book a lot here because I've read the book so many times. In the book early on, Caramon is embarrassed at finding Tika attractive because he knew her as a young girl. And she is described as being very voluptuous at this age. And she is fairly young. And that's one of the things that didn't really come across in the animation was that Tanis, because he's a half-elf, and Flint are the oldest members in the group by a long shot. But even even Sturm is very young. All the rest of them are fairly young comparatively. And later on, Tika is actually embarrassed at her figure when she's, you know, kind of looking at Lorana saying, you know, wow, look how graceful she is. I feel like a klutz. So, you know, it's okay to address that and then later, you know, develop what she's feeling about herself, but you don't get any of that. You don't get anything below the skin except maybe a little bit of Tanis's self-doubt. And even though Tanis is the heart of the story, I mean, there's so much material there that
they really seem to focus on the faith aspect in this movie. That was sort of the driving message, I guess.
Yes. And then again, I go back to the fact that if they had done the first book, just the first part of that, they could have really focused on that. And the other thing that I seem to be missing was the fact that the first time they saw a dragon, it should have been monumental because they have not supposedly existed in Kryn, the world that they inhabit.
They glossed over Pax Darkus. They like reduced it to about 5 minutes or so. It was
There was a lot of things, and there was the scene where Gold Moon, you know, jumps down the rope to get out of the Inn of the Last Home, and she's afraid of heights, and that's a big point that they make. Once they're in Pax Tharkas and she has to climb down, and they kind of glossed over all of that. And because they, you know, the way they treated Pax Tharkas as this quick, you know, 5 minute jaunt.
Yeah, it really should have been like the Moria of the movie, like Moria was in the Lord of the Rings movies. It should have been that big.
Well, and there was so much going on there. There was political intrigue. There was trying to work with the Gully Dwarves, Flint's reaction to the Gully Dwarves, how much he hates them. I mean, there was so much character interaction there that could have been, you know, played off of, and they
pretty much reduced Boo Boo to like two lines. And what was the Black Dragon's name? Onyx?
Yes.
Yeah, her voice did not match what she looked like. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just got random female voice actor B to do her voice, and what was up with all the dragons like having a human shape? Why was that in the books? I don't remember that.
I don't remember that either. But if they had played that up more as the very first time you saw a dragon and realized that this person was in fact a dragon, because I think the dragons were hidden from view for the most part of the series. Until you literally got into Pax Tharkas. And actually, I think I've been calling it the wrong thing. I think it's Pax Saroth is the one that slid underground, and
yeah,
Pax Tharkas.
Yeah, underground place. I don't remember. Zaxxaroth.
Zaxxaroth, thank you. Yeah, and Pax Tharkas is the prison, what became the prison. It was the last.
Yeah, they like the letter X in Dragonlance.
Exactly. So it for something that had so much depth, so much intrigue, so much character development, it really was kind of glossed over as kind of like a Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah.
So you guys have been doing a fine job here. Given all the information you have about it and having seen it, do you think it's going to be successful enough that we'll see the next book converted to film also?
I hope not.
Yeah, I would be very surprised unless it was funded privately. I don't see, and I have to say, I rented it. I did not hear anything about the film other than it was going to be released on a certain date. And one of my cohorts in the inner circle, Victor, had said, well, you know, it's on sale today at Best Buy. And I said, how much is it? It's $12. Well, I'd consider buying that. And then he said how badly it was being panned. It's like, I don't know if I want to spend that if that's truly the case, but I do want to see the film. So we ended up going to our local Blockbuster. It was available for rent. I think there was only one copy in the entire Blockbuster rack for this. So, and before we had started recording, Jeff, you had said that you didn't think there was one anywhere near you, and you've been waiting on it for Netflix.
Right. Well, and I think part of that is that you get these direct-to-DVD movies, and the larger companies like Netflix or Blockbuster or whoever are going to assume that it's not going to have a very large following, and so they don't order as many copies. So it's going to be harder to find, I think, than your typical, you know, Blockbuster DVD release.
The thing that I noticed in the months leading up to the release of this movie, there was lots of buzz on the internet. There was an article in Dragon Magazine, but there was no real advertising for this movie. There was a web page, but it was like a blog. There was nothing. They're really not. I mean, I can't understand why such a big property with such big name actors would not be more visually advertised. It really struck me as very strange.
Yeah, but now you know why.
Well, I think the Xena and Hercules cartoon did better.
Yeah, a lot of times I think
has Lucy Lawless in it. She's playing Goldmoon for some reason.
Yeah. I think what happens a lot of times when a studio greenlights a project like this and they start to sort of talk about it and they start to get a buzz going and then they start to get actual film back and figure out what it's like, you can sort of tell if a movie is going to be very good based off of how much advertising support the studio puts behind it. And so the fact that it hadn't been talked about much and there hadn't been a lot of advertising for it and that kind of thing probably should have been our first clue that it wasn't going to live up to expectations.
And it's so hard because that's it exactly, is if I had no expectations going into this and truthfully in trying to review something, you almost have to leave your expectations behind. And that was one of the reasons why initially I did not like the Dragonlance movie when I saw, or excuse me, the Dungeons and Dragons movie when I saw it in the theaters. It was only years later that I came back to it and tried to leave all that baggage behind and watch it and really kind of see it for what it was that I was able to appreciate it. But this one, because it was, when it comes to fictional novels, the fantasy realm, the Dragonlance series, especially the ones written by Hickman and Weiss, were just so close to my heart in that I have read them so many times. Granted, I haven't kept up with them all over the years, but those core initial books, the six initial books, the anthologies that came afterwards and so forth, those were all very, very close to my heart. And it kind of defined a way of playing Dungeons and Dragons as well and broke the mold of it's not just a dungeon crawl. It's not just a what do I kill and what do I get. But there was romance. There was character development. There was intrigue. There was changing of allegiances. There was all this wonderful stuff that just seemed to get, you know, diluted in this very short animated film.
Sure. And I know the little buzz that I really heard about it was mostly from Tracy Hickman's podcast. He did several episodes and it got me really excited about it. And I've been really looking forward to the release. And then you have the release and even he didn't talk as much about it, I don't think, in the, you know, month or two just prior to the release of the movie, which should have, I suppose, been a clue. I just assumed he was, you know, too busy doing other things to get out new episodes.
Yeah, I kind of wonder about that. I know that last year, this past Gen Con, some of the crew from Inner Circle had gotten a chance to speak with, I want to say it's Jason Marsden, who did the voice of Tessa Hoff Burfoot and
Jason Marsden.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Good. And you know, that was kind of exciting to hear a little bit about it beforehand. But going back to what Jeff had mentioned about some of the technical inconsistencies, I think at one point through the film, or actually several points through the film, I watched Tasselhoff's hoopak change shape. First it was a stick, then it was this really oversized slingshot, and then it was something else. And I mean, that was something that is so, it identifies him so much for who he is that I can't believe that they couldn't even get it consistent throughout the film. And you didn't get to hear the bull roar effect of it in the first encounter with the goblins. So I'm not one that typically is very negative about things, but I was disappointed ultimately in the product.
So the ultimate conclusion we're coming to is voice acting maybe done decently well. The story was okay, but a lot of the animation and the technical work was where this movie really fell apart.
I would agree, and I would probably add that it's by no means even scratches the surface of the depth that is contained in the original novel.
This is a horrible movie, and I could not even watch it again.
So, a stunning recommendation. however, if people are interested in experiencing this story the way it was originally created, and that is as an adventure, they did just release the latest of the new series of adventures to take people through the Dragonlance story again as players.
The last third edition Dragonlance products before they take the license back.
Right, but this last product happens to be part three of the adventures. They've recreated the adventures for 3.5, so people can actually go through and play their big 3.5 giant Dragonlance campaign and experience what it was like to go through that story and hopefully get a lot of the depth and other things that were missing from the movie.
I would highly recommend looking at the novel and exploring the worlds of Dragonlance through role-playing, definitely. I don't think the film does any of that justice.
Yeah, skip the film. Go read the books.
Great, and I've even got a review as soon as I get around to it of the... There's some prequels that came out. The one I've specifically finished now is Soulforge, and then there's another one that's a follow-up to that follows the twins, Caramon and Raceland, and sort of their background and their childhood, and they go through exactly what happened during Raceland's test, and you get a lot of the story of Tika as a child, and all the, you know, you see how the party first starts forming in those early years, and it's really a very interesting story to go back and revisit, having not read the original books myself for a very long time.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of the how they first got together in the actual novels. Surprisingly, there was a great bit of story in the fifth module. The original fifth module gave you the background for the characters, which is kind of funny. You play through four modules, and then you get the background for the characters.
Well, I just always assumed that they were members of Weiss's and Hickman's D&D group, and the authors just took the players' characters and made new stories out of them.
It's my understanding from hearing the stories from Weiss and Hickman that's more or less the case. In fact, if you read some of the forewords in some of the books, they talk about how, yeah, they created this Raceland character because they figured they needed a wizard, and then they handed it to one of their players, and they had no idea who this guy was or what his personality was going to be, and because of the way that guy played it, he turned into this huge character that we all know now as Raceland.
Yeah, let's preface that or kind of clarify that a little bit. They, as authors, did some of the playtesting of the original modules, but the characters did not exist prior to the modules. It's not like, you know, somebody was, like they were sitting around playing and they came up with this idea. Dragonlance was conceived as a whole, as a project from Tracy Hickman, who wanted to make this 12-issue run of or 12-module run of adventures that were linked thematically by dragons. And so they created all the characters for the modules, and there's very little background in the original modules. But through the play, through the play testing of that, that's how certain instances came into being that were part and parcel and actually the heart of the novel, such as Raceland's treatment of Bupu, the way Raceland spoke and his demeanor and things like that. A lot of that did come from the play. I had the pleasure of speaking with Harold Johnson, I hope I'm getting the name right, who actually played Tasselhoff in the original playtesting of the modules, and he had some wonderful insights of the character.
That's cool. That's almost as cool as talking to Gygax's original group.
Yeah.
I would love to talk to some of them.
I bet they would have great stories.
Yeah.
Well, any last thoughts on Dragonlance the movie or the Dragons of Autumn Twilight movie before we go ahead and wrap this up?
I'm done beating my dead horse.
I hope this doesn't keep Kiefer Sutherland from doing more fantasy, because he has a good voice and he should do other projects that are better suited to his talents.
Well, and ultimately, I think that's part of the big risk involved in this film in general, is that people had really high hopes that they were going to put together this great story and they were going to create a great movie, and it was going to lead people to realize, oh, look at what these gaming people are doing. Look at what these kinds of stories are all about. Look at how cool this kind of stuff is. And unfortunately, we get a movie that continues the stereotype of, look at those crazy gamers and the silly things that they do.
Now, we don't know this, but if somebody came to this clear out of the blue, no background, no understanding what Dragonlance was, but kind of watched this as a, this looks interesting, dragons and warriors and all that, kind of a Lord of the Rings kind of a thing, let's watch this. And then from there, we're able to experience and explore the world of the novels and the games and so forth. That would be a really great thing. My viewpoint today has been the viewpoint of the fan who has known about Dragonlance all along and has come to this with that expectation in mind.
But I think someone watching this movie with no background of the novels would just get bored and turn it off. I think it's that bad.
And would they be able to get? Do you think they'd be able to get past the technical problems like the animation?
I was nitpicking it because I knew what to look for. So, my acid test is do my 9 and 11-year-old like it? And neither of them had the opportunity to watch it. But I was thinking this would be something that all three of us could watch, and I would be picking up different things that were written at a more adult level, and they would get into the action of it. And sadly, neither of them got into watching the film.
Okay. Well, this has been our little chat about the Dragonlance movie, Dragons of Autumn Twilight. Hopefully, people at least get something out of the film, and hopefully it doesn't turn people off if it's as bad as people keep saying that it is, especially Jeff over here. I look forward to checking it out myself here in a few days, a few weeks, whenever Netflix gets it over to me. And then I'd be happy to add my thoughts to the conversation as well. But thanks again, guys, for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, that's the Dragonlance movie. Thanks again to JJ and Jeffrey for joining the show once again and for your honest thoughts about the movie. Now, a quick promo from Fistful of Comics and Games, a great series of shows about all sorts of geeky things.
Podcasting from their secret satellite headquarters.
Dude, it's your kitchen.
Three friends gather around the dais of discourse,
like at your mom's kitchen table,
to battle boredom and bash finality,
armed with only a fistful of comics
and games.
Okay, Night Ranger, it looks like you've angered the Kobold Shaman, and he's about to cast a spell at you. What do you do?
Is he wearing boots?
What does that have to do with anything?
Well, it might cause arcane spell failure.
Okay, yes, he's wearing high hard leather boots.
Well, in that case, I'll attack with my longsword.
Okay, roll to hit.
13.
That's a miss.
Working man?
What is it, Tangent? Can't you see that we're playing Keep on the Borderlands?
Well, I don't want to interrupt you, but we just got an urgent email from the Inker from Mutant Warrior Base on the planet Zargon, and he wants to know what our podcast is all about. What do you want me to tell him?
Well, tell him that we're a roundtable discussion with a revolving cast.
Okay, I've got that. Now what?
Well, tell him that we have topics about comics, games, and other related media, like TV, movies, and novels.
Okay, I've got that.
Well, don't forget to tell them about our comics, gaming, and sci-fi convention coverage.
Well, yeah, and our interviews with game and comic creators.
Yeah, sounds like everything he needs to get his geek on.
Well, I'll just finish up by saying that you can reach us at www.fistfulofcomics.com.
That's great. Now can we get back to our game?
Well, I want to keep you.
Okay, great. All right, so he finishes casting his spell, and he fires a magic missile at you. Take 3 points of damage.
But I have boots on.
Well, that's episode 45. As always, I urge and welcome listeners to help the show in any way you can. Send in your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can also dig the show at dig.com or leave an iTunes review. These things help the show get noticed, and I appreciate that. Also, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store. The show gets a percentage of the proceeds, and that helps keep the show on the air. All of this information, the forum, and more can be found at the website at www.thetomeshow.com. Also, don't forget to check out the Tome's partner podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, which we've already talked about, and Gamer's Haven at www.canadiancrusaders.com for some great GMly advice. They've recently released the last bits of their content from last year's Gen Con, and it's all looking very good. This has been episode 45, Dragonlance, the movie of
The Tome. The Tome. The Tome. The Tome. The Tome. The Tome.